Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Contemporary Fiction by Russian Women and Third World Literature, this week on Soundings. You'll hear from Helena Gostillo of the University of Pittsburgh and Michael Valdez-Moses of Duke University. I'll talk first this week with Helena Gostillo about her study of contemporary Russian women writers. Following that, I'll talk to Michael Valdez-Moses about literature and the Third World. Helena Gostillo's books include Balancing Acts, Recent Fiction by Russian Women, a collection of translations and critical introductions available from Indiana University Press. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Helena Gostillo is working on a project entitled Heritage and Heresy, Contemporary Fiction by Russian Women. Here is Helena Gostillo.
I would say that in the 19th century, Russian women in general were pushed into the background for a variety of reasons, one of them being that the production of literature, like the production of anything else but babies, was very much in the hands of men.
Mm-hmm. But these women were writing nonetheless. That's the important
That's
thing,
right.
I take it.
They were writing nonetheless, but what you also have to understand is the following. Russia is a country which suffers from graphomaniacs.
Say that again?
Russia is a country which suffers from graphomania. Uh-huh. People write, everybody writes, much more than necessary,
what,
much more than
diaries,
desirable.
Diaries, letters?
Everyone believes that he potentially is a writer.
Uh-huh.
No, so it is totally normal for somebody who's a scientist or a doctor or a philosopher or somebody whose specialization...
To be working on a novel or writing poetry?
Yes, uh-huh. Especially to write poetry and to write short stories. A novel naturally needs more commitment, plus it also demands a certain capacity for coping with structures, mm-hmm. larger structures.
And women are a part of this phenomenon.
Women most definitely are part of this phenomenon. And I think for a lot of women, writing really is a psychological release.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that you have not had the church. We've not had psychologists to whom women could go and communicate some of their very understandable dissatisfactions, mm-hmm. melancholy, and so on with life.
Well, what special themes are Russian women writing about? What kind of, give mm-hmm. me the long foreground to the short, rather immediate picture.
Uh-huh.
What were their concerns?
I would say that women, by and large, in the early 19th century and throughout the 19th century and even now, have tended to write about themselves, about family life, about the inability of people around them to understand their inner world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them wrote about the inability to break out into a wider universe. Let me just give you an example of the animus against women that exists in Russian society. And it is an animus that women themselves have internalized. A lot of the women writers I interviewed, and many, many people I spoke to in the Soviet Union, both earlier this year and in 1988, when I went there under the auspices of IREX to interview various women in connection with several projects, while I was there, I told people I was working with women's literature. Now, the actual term women's literature means poor literature.
Oh, my goodness.
Various women writers, including such extraordinarily talented people as Tatiana Tolstaya, Petrushevskaya, Victoria Tokareva, see women's literature as being synonymous with, as they put it, saccharine, stereotype.
The Ladies' Home Journal.
Yes. Or maybe something which is also a little bit like Harlequin romance.
Uh-huh.
Now, what is interesting, Tolstaya, for example, says that a lot of men also write women's literature. And the logical then...
Under women's names or men's names?
No, under men's names. In other words, she says, well, women's literature is not exclusively intrinsic to women. But if that is so, then why is it called women's literature.
Well, how do these women, these contemporary women writers in Russia that you're looking at, Helena Goshchilo, mm-hmm. how are they going to dig themselves out of this trench? It sounds to me like it's nothing but an uphill battle.
Yes, it is. I agree with that. I think it is. I think several things might help. While in most other areas of life I think I'm optimistic, there I'm somewhat less optimistic, in part because of having struggled in various conversations with women to lead them along logical ways, along logical paths. I would say that one of the problems with introducing a greater self-awareness, what I suppose you would have to call it, feminism, to the Soviet Union is the following. First of all, with the discrediting of Marxist-Leninism and socialism in general now, ideology as a mass movement of any kind has been discredited too.
Well, these women have to reconstitute themselves, therefore, ideologically. They're inventing mm-hmm. themselves. They have something of a tradition that you're trying to trace and define, mm-hmm. and yet it's very fluid, very organic. They can pretty much do with it as they choose. Have I got this right?
Well, in a sense, yes, in a sense, no. I think habits are very strong in the Soviet Union. It is still an incredibly conservative country, okay? And, you know, there are historical reasons for various factors that are still there in place today. For example, the fact that during the Second World War, such a high percentage of the male population was decimated. What that meant is that women had to fulfill various roles that men had formerly on the job.
Including literature.
Including anything and everything. You mentioned it, women were doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what that means is that women, I think, you must have heard of the expression, a double burden. Mm-hmm. Women in the Soviet Union, especially since the Second World War, have worked full-time. Then they have come home and they have been exclusively, entirely responsible for all household tasks. Okay. That leaves women very little time for a political engagement, very little time for anything outside of the job that will bring in money and the household, which is entirely their responsibility.
And as usual, art becomes the sort of poor
luxury.
Cousin, yeah, or
it
a luxury,
luxury
that comes along
yes.
as not as an afterthought, but just mm-hmm. With the remnants of one's energy.
Exactly. And I do know definitely of women, for example, a woman like Petrushevskaya, who though she only has been published extensively recently, she has been trying to, she was trying to get into print, to, I suppose you would call hit the big time,
right.
For about 25 years. She did this writing in the corner in the kitchen after her children were in bed, right? She was the one who just took care of the children. That is a normal situation in the Soviet Union. And as you might not know right now, the family is undergoing all kinds of problems. There is a high divorce rate. There is a lot of hooliganism, problems with adolescents, and so on. Invariably, even under Gorbachev, various newspapers and journals, when they write about the disintegration of the family, they see it as a problem connected with women.
Well, they're
with
looking
mothers.
They're looking for excuses more than anything else.
They are, but you know, I honestly think that they believe there is what a feminist call essentialization in the Soviet Union.
Hmm.
The belief that a woman is not only biologically, but that she is psychologically in an always different from a man.
Well, she has been ideologically, and now you gotta you have to break that mindset.
In a lot of these stories, which are just now entering public journals and so on, where before they were in the drawer, they would not have been published earlier. A lot of the stories now deal with women in hospitals, women having abortions.
Hmm.
As I mentioned to you before in a private conversation, women have an average, during a lifetime, women have an average of 12 abortions.
In the Soviet Union.
In the Soviet Union. Goodness. There are instances of some women who have had over 20, some 25.
Mm.
These are statistics, actually, which are supplied by Soviet sources. So it's not impossible that the numbers are even higher.
And that kind of thing has to affect the collective consciousness of these women writers.
Definitely. Definitely. And what happens, I think, in situations like that is that, first of all, why has nothing been done about contraception? The major means of contraception in the Soviet Union, or the major means of birth control,
is abortion. Oh, my goodness.
Now, you understand why. The Soviets, especially men, call their rubbers, they call them galoshes.
Uh-huh.
game. There's a very good reason as to why they're called galoshes. They are thick enough to be worn as such if your feet are small enough, right? They are also, despite their thickness, they apparently also have a tendency to snap during intercourse. So what is it that people can do? All right, people can either give up having intercourse, which certainly most men are not willing to, though many of the women I've spoken to have expressed that they would be ready to do so.
Right.
Women can continue having abortions. Or women can try, I suppose, the rhythm method. There is only now a slight smattering of knowledge among younger women about sex. There has been no sex education in the Soviet Union at all.
And you think that this is an issue that one of it's difficult, Helena Gostiello, to make the jump from social policy and the collective ideological mindset into the realm of aesthetics and literature, but you think that there is a connection there?
Well, let me put it like this. In much of the literature that I've dealt with, there is no story that I can think of that deals with the theme of, let's say, contraception. But many of the stories that are good deal with women who gather in, let us say, Yulia Vesnesenskaya, the women's Decameron, or Yelena Makarova's story, which is no cutlets for those who are going to have an abortion, or other stories which deal with hospitals. All of these works, which have the hospital setting, tend to raise these issues.
So we're in a sort of a transitional phase where women are able to raise the issues rather indirectly and yet speak to these social issues in respectively aesthetic, expressive fiction.
Yes, absolutely. Now, not all women do this. For example, Tolstaya does not directly concern herself with social issues, though some of her stories, I think, do show the negative consequences of stereotyping in general. Mm-hmm. And in three of her stories, at least, I think those stories are susceptible to a feminist reading.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there are writers such as Nina Katerli, right? Ludmila Uvarova, who died recently, Irina Vilimbovskaya, who also died recently, who indeed in their works fairly directly address such problems as male alcoholism, beating of women, the fact that women are in a constant state of exhaustion because of the housework, bearing a lot of children, having abortions, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that definitely when it comes to themes, women's problems do enter contemporary Russian women's fiction.
Helena Gostiello, let's conclude our conversation. Your book is Balancing Acts, a collection of contemporary Russian women's literature. Who are you going to read from? Tell me what this is.
From Nina Katerli's story, Between Spring and Summer. This is a monologue, an internal monologue on the part of a male in the story. Equal rights, of course, but equality had turned out to mean that a man was no longer the master of his home, but that he was the least important person in it. What had happened to men? And where had these women come from who ran everything, whether at home or on the job? And suddenly Vasya understood what had happened. War had happened, not once, but three times. And remember, all three right in a row. And what was the result? The men had been killed off, and the women were left with the kids. Who was the head of the house? The strongest? The smartest? Who was the protector? Who knew how to do everything? The mother. Okay, now the daughter grows up and gets married. How will she handle everything in her own family? Naturally, like her mother, since she hasn't known anything else. Not that she would have to nag or yell at her husband. She would just treat him the way a mother treats her child, teaching him, making him do things her way, wiping his nose. And he'd like it just fine. At first, poor fellow. It was what he expected, was used to. His father had been killed, his mother had raised him, and the first thing he looked for in a wife was a mammy, to fuss over him, cater to him, baby him. There it was, the war. So many years later, its influence could still be felt. The war, the war. That was the whole problem. And it wasn't equal rights. Quite the contrary. Equal rights were good, our big achievement. But raising kids without fathers, a disaster.
Helena Gostiello teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. During a fellowship year at the center, Helena Gostiello is at work on a project entitled Heritage and Heresy, Contemporary Fiction by Russian Women. Her collection of writing by Russian women, a volume entitled Balancing Acts, is available from Indiana University Press. Soundings continues now with a discussion about third world literature. I'll talk next with Michael Valdez Moses, a professor of English at Duke University. Michael Valdez Moses specializes in contemporary third world fiction, political history and the novel, and fiction in the post-colonial world. Michael Moses, tell me this. How does the reading and the teaching of literature about the third world, how does that reshape our notion of what we call our Western canon, our literary inheritance?
I think that we have a false polarity in existence right now, that there is first world literature on the one side mm-hmm. and third world literature on the other, and they have nothing in common.
They're not enemies.
No, I don't think so at all. Indeed, I think a truly comparative approach benefits all sides, that everybody gains from reading both kinds of literatures, and we find all sorts of influences or surprises. Mm-hmm. For instance, if I were to say, well, let's read Sir Walter Scott, the usual response is, well, how can we have a more canonical writer than Scott? Uh-huh. But if I were to say, let's read an author who's concerned with the process of detribalization, of what it is to take a rural or agricultural economy which is introduced into a modern capitalist one, one which has suffered imperial domination, one in which the issue of the loss of a native language and the adaptation of a foreign tongue is of great concern, one doesn't ordinarily think of a novel like Waverley or of Scott's novels.
And there it is.
And there it is. Uh-huh. So that, in fact, our view of first world literature or of European literature as somehow disconnected from these concerns of third world literature is false. If one were to eliminate all of the Irish writers from 20th century British literature, right. one has a very short list. After one dispenses with Joyce and Yeats and O'Casey and right. Singh and Wilde, so that if one were to see Irish writers as post-colonial writers, one has a very different idea of the shape and the texture of so-called canonical writing.
Well, again, let me argue with you, Michael Moses. Apart from our political sympathies, apart from the fact that we will look at a population and say, yes, it's been oppressed, yes, it's been denied its culture and its language, the fact nevertheless remains that you have to make some choices, and you have to say that one kind of literature is better than another. It's more expressive, it's richer, it's deeper. And when you make choices, you make discriminations. Now, is that always a dirty word when you look at first world and third world literature?
Most certainly not. I think if you were working in a field like post-colonial or third world literature, you have to make the same sorts of choices all the time. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal of literature. You can't teach it all. So that it's impossible to dispense with hierarchies or standards of judgment. One has to say that Garcia Marquez is better than other writers from Latin America, and therefore he is more deserving of being taught. Mm-hmm. Or that Jean Rhys is a great Caribbean writer, and she deserves to be taught.
Michael Moses, why the 1990s? Why are we now paying attention to the literature of the third world in a way that we didn't before?
In part, it's because there has been an explosion of literary talent in many regions of the world. There are a number of reasons for that. In the first place, I think the period of colonization, decolonization, and independence in areas of the world like Africa have given writers the kind of subject matter that begs for literary treatment.
Also given them the freedom to try to do this stuff.
As well. In addition, and I would take Africa as an example, colonization and independence have meant the establishment of a modern education system, so that the rate of literacy has grown and authors now have a wider audience. It has meant, in the cases of most African nations, the establishment of a national language rather than a tribal one, which enables a writer to communicate with an African as opposed to an Igbo or Gikuyu audience. And it also has meant that writers have been educated in a modern university system, which was unavailable to them prior to this.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, Michael Moses, that these writers that you teach, Chinua Achebe, an African writer, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a Colombian, do they write to their own people? Do they write to the New York literary establishment?
I think, in fact, most of them do write for their own people. I think that they don't necessarily write strictly for Colombians or Nigerians. I think they are very conscious about writing for Latin Americans or for Africans. They are certainly aware of the New York or the London publishing establishment. But Achebe has pointed out that When Things Fall Apart was first printed, it sold something like 6,000 copies the first year in the United States, Europe, or elsewhere outside of Africa, but it sold 20,000 copies in Africa. So indeed, even their sales, I think, are generated within these societies.
Would you say that literature by and about third world populations, by third world writers, is it necessarily political in the sense that we attach an ideological dimension to it?
I would say that it's political insofar as the subject matter of much of the writing from these regions of the world are indeed concerned with political subjects.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned with revolutions, they're concerned with tyrants, they're concerned with issues of economic and social justice, and in a way that is relatively unusual in contemporary American fiction.
Well, why would that be a threat, for example, to the old guard? I mean, we can take things, the so-called cultural canon that we receive from writers like Hawthorne or Faulkner or James Whitcomb Riley, and can't you go back and find a political dimension there as well?
Oh, I think most certainly. Indeed, I would say that if you take canonical writers like Shakespeare, for instance, mm-hmm. he is most explicitly concerned with political questions. One has only to look at the tragedies or the history plays to see that Shakespeare's primary interest, in my opinion, is politics.
Uh-huh. What about the charge, Michael Moses, that these works by and about third world writers and populations are aesthetically weak, that the teaching of third world literature is, after all, again, a political apology for aesthetic or structural weaknesses? They really don't measure up to the good stuff from the West, quote unquote.
Well, I would have to say that in the first place, the writers that I'm most interested in are consummate artists, in that sense in which the old guard means an artist.
Uh-huh.
That, in fact, what is most impressive about much of this literature is that it not only has an extraordinary subject matter, which has a kind of epic feel to it, but that this subject matter is presented in an aesthetically sophisticated fashion.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back to something that you've written, Michael Moses. You have a piece called Caliban and His Precursors, and it's about politics and literary history. Can't we say that Shakespeare really said it all when he created the character of Caliban? Here's something here's a creature, a literary creation that attracts us and repels us, that teaches us the best and the worst about ourselves. Why do we need to reinvent the wheel by looking at all these writers from the third world?
Well, I think political situations and literature changes over time, so that the precise or exact political circumstances in which Shakespeare wrote or about which he wrote
uh-huh.
are not necessarily those of contemporary third world society.
Is that to deny the transcendence of literary value? Is that to say that literature has to be local and political? And for example, we have prominent people such as Mrs. Cheney at the National Endowment for the Humanities, who argues that literature is necessarily universal. That's what really attracts us as not as a particular culture, but as a world population to what we call the classics. And yet, the argument today seems to be that no, it's always local, it's always political. What about that?
I don't see those two arguments as being necessarily incompatible with each other. In other words, one would understand Shakespeare's plays better, for instance, the Roman plays, by knowing something about Roman history, by reading Polybius, for instance. Mm-hmm. By the same token, I think that it's an astonishing fact that Shakespeare remains as a universal writer of universal significance.
No, wait, that astonishes you?
No, it doesn't astonish me.
It does not astonish
me. It does not astonish me. I think it shouldn't surprise us.
Uh-huh.
By the same token, Garcia Marquez, who is a Colombian, has found an international audience. The contemporary writer Salman Rushdie, for instance, has been heavily influenced by Garcia Marquez, mm-hmm. as have others. So I think the fact that writing can be concerned with the local and the particular and the political is no barrier to universal appeal.
Mm-hmm. You think about things like that when you go into the classroom and teach the literature of the first or the third world?
Oh, certainly. I think that is my primary task, is to engage the minds of young students. I think what I can introduce is to engage students with literary, aesthetic, political, social, and philosophic questions, which forces them to think and to debate and to discuss these issues in a lively fashion. And the way I feel that I can best engage them is to take seriously issues about what kind of human beings we are, what kind of human beings we ought to be, what is the best kind of society we can imagine, what is the best kind of society we can practically envision, mm-hmm. existing in a contemporary situation.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of human beings constitute the highest type of human being?
Let's conclude. Here's a footnote question, Michael Moses. We've talked about Chinua Achebe. We've talked about some Latin American writers. Name a work, name a book that you'd recommend to our listeners. Get them started on a healthy diet of third world literature.
Oh, I'd probably start with Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. And perhaps Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, and Achebe's Things Fall Apart. That would make a grand start on anyone's reading list.
Michael Valdez Moses is a professor at Duke University. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Michael Valdez Moses teaches contemporary third world fiction, political history and the novel, and fiction in the post-colonial world. Soundings is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 552. That's program number 552. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, the topic will be Southerners in Combat. Julian Pleasance and Augustus Burns III will discuss their new book, Frank Porter Graham and the 1950 Senate Race in North Carolina. I'll also talk to James R. Wilson about his new book, Landing Zones, Southern Veterans Remember Vietnam. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Contemporary fiction by Russian women and third world literature, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Helena Goschillo of the University of Pittsburgh and Michael Valdez Moses of Duke University. Helena Goschillo talks about her study of contemporary Russian women writers. Michael Valdez Moses discusses modern-day third world writing and its relation to the American cultural canon. Multicultures, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.